From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. And this week, we're starting the show a little different. We're taking a stroll through one of America's wealthiest neighborhoods, Manhattan's Upper East Side. In this part of the city, you'll find museums like the Guggenheim and the Met. And if you make your way up Park Avenue, two blocks over from Central Park, what you'll really notice along this tree-lined boulevard are these imposing residential buildings full of apartments bigger than most people's houses. Reveal's Aaron Glantz is in front of one of them right now. Hey, Aaron.
Hi, Al. I'm in front of 740 Park Avenue. It's known as the world's richest apartment building. It's a gorgeous Art Deco building built back in the 1920s. Once it was home to John D. Rockefeller Jr., and now it's home to a lot of Donald Trump's closest friends and advisors. In fact, I'm looking down the street right now, and I can see the gold of Trump Tower.
Okay, so who exactly lives at 740 Park Avenue?
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, for one. So does Steve Schwarzman, founder of Blackstone, the giant private equity firm. Mogul Tom Barrack, one of Donald Trump's closest friends. He has an apartment in the neighborhood, too.
Aaron, I know you've been investigating these guys for years. They don't just have Trump and a fancy address in common, though. So what's the real story here?
I'm here because the people who live in this building, they're the people who hoovered up the wealth of hundreds of thousands of people. When millions of Americans lost their wealth, who got it? These people. I call them the homewreckers.
Homewreckers, that's the title of your new book, and you've been looking into how they manipulated our economy.
Right. When 8 million Americans lost their homes during the Great Recession, these men stepped in and made a killing. Most of the time, these homewreckers didn't have to break the rules. They took advantage of a rigged system and even got the government's help. And now, with Trump in office, some of them are making the rules.
Now, to understand how they pulled this off, you have to understand how people who live in that building on Park Avenue are connected to a house nearly 3,000 miles away. It's in a suburb just north of Los Angeles. Aaron went there over the summer.
681 Benson Way is the sort of home that you'll find all over America. It's 1,500 square feet. Built in 1965, it has a two-car garage, decorative wooden shutters, and a small patch of lawn with a lemon tree out front. I've come here because all those homewreckers made money off this simple suburban home. And it all started with an ad.
Hi, this is James Garner for Financial Freedom.
It was 2005, and Richard Hickerson was sitting in the living room of this house in his overstuffed brown easy chair, his golden retriever at his side. His wife, Patricia, was a few feet away sitting on the sofa. They had lived here for decades. Now in their late 70s, they were spending a lot of time just like this, watching TV.
If you're 62 or older and own your own home, I'd like to talk to you about something you should know.
The pitchman was one of Dick's favorite actors from the 70s.
It's called a reverse mortgage, and it's a safe, easy way to quickly turn your home equity into tax-free money. If you're a homeowner 62 or older, why not give Financial Freedom a call? Who knows? It might just change your life, too.
Dick and Patricia had worked and saved their whole lives. They had $300,000 in the bank, plus hundreds of thousands of dollars in equity in the house on Benson Way. But Dick was worried about the future. So when he saw the ad, Dick dialed the number on his screen. And soon a salesman arrived at their door with a red, white, and blue PowerPoint presentation. The last slide read, "So you ask, what's the catch?" None. Dick and Patricia signed on the dotted line. Now, Dick and Patricia weren't living alone. Their oldest daughter, Sandy Jolly, had moved home to live with her parents.
They asked me if I would come home. My dad was suffering from terminal cancer. He was on narcotic pain medication, and he was drinking heavily for the pain. And my mom had Alzheimer's. She couldn't do numbers or anything.
Moving home was a big change for Sandy. She was a fiercely independent woman. When she was 19, she ran off with an airline pilot and became a flight attendant, back when they used to call them stewardesses. She and the pilot had a child together, then divorced. Sandy raised her daughter as a single mother. She was working in India managing a nonprofit when her parents got sick, and she came home. Sandy had moved home to protect her parents, but they'd signed the reverse mortgage without even telling her. And then, 3 weeks later, something horrible happened. Dick went into the hospital for yet another surgery.
He never came out of intensive care.
Dick ended up dying in the hospital.
That just weighed on my heart. It was so traumatic, I can't even tell you.
Sandy was grieving, but she still had to care for her mother. And she had to sort out the family finances. So Sandy and her sister went upstairs to her parents' home office and opened the drawers.
And so we started going through all the files, the file cabinet.
What she found in that file cabinet, it would spark a 10-year battle between Sandy and the homewreckers.
I found 14 pages of a reverse mortgage contract. My sister and I decided we were going to find out what the heck is this.
Her father had just died. Dialing this mortgage company was the last thing Sandy wanted to do. But she found herself on the phone day after day.
I started calling the reverse mortgage company and said, this money is sitting in the bank. We have no use for it. We need our property to care for my mom, and I want to give it back. And they refused. And they refused two more times after that.
A reverse mortgage allows seniors to take money out of their homes. And in exchange, when they die, the bank can take the house. At the time, the house on Benson Way was worth about $500,000. Financial Freedom paid what was left on Dick and Patricia's mortgage, about $120,000, and put $80,000 in their savings account, money they'd never need to pay back. But the company also charged them $20,000 in fees. Every month thereafter, there'd be more fees, and the interest would compound. And after they both died, Financial Freedom would be able to take the house. This was during the housing bubble. Home prices were skyrocketing, and banks were hell-bent on making as many loans as possible, no matter how improbable. That is, until the party ended.
Fear, anger, and high anxiety were the prevailing emotions outside branches of the failed IndyMac Bank out in California.
Bill Whitaker. That reverse mortgage company, Financial Freedom, it was part of a huge bank called IndyMac, which you might remember from its infamous downfall during the financial crisis.
Relax, you idiots!
Let's not fight!
The federal government, in the form of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, stepped in to take it over. Now the government was in the unpleasant position of owning this disaster of a bank. And while customers jostled on the streets of Pasadena, bank regulators in Washington were scrambling too. At the center of the crisis was Sheila Bair, chair of the FDIC. A Republican from Kansas, she'd been appointed by George W. Bush. Now, Bair's often portrayed as a hero, one of the few federal officials who stuck up for consumers during the financial crisis. People like Warren Buffett sang her praises.
You got a wonderful person with Sheila Bair. Most of the viewers have never heard of Sheila Bair. It's been a magnificent job. Nobody's ever heard of her. She'll never get a golden parachute or any severance pay or anything. She's done a great job.
Sheila Bair's job was to safeguard consumer deposits, which meant stabilizing the banks. The last thing she wanted was to keep IndyMac on the government's books.
It was one of the worst of the worst. I mean, and that says a lot, because there was a lot of bad mortgage lending going around.
It was the summer of 2008. The economy was teetering, and Sheila Bair was stuck with IndyMac. She put it up for auction and waited for bidders. But the entire banking industry was collapsing, and she couldn't find one that wanted to buy it.
I will confidently say, of the options we had, we picked the best ones we could. There weren't always good options.
Well, you had one bidder, so yeah. You picked the best option you had.
That's right. Yes, we did.
The only bidder was an investment group headed by Steve Mnuchin. Years before he became President Trump's Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin was just a hedge fund guy who'd once worked for Goldman Sachs. He lived in that opulent apartment building on Park Avenue that we told you about earlier. He was mostly known as the son of Robert Mnuchin, a top executive at Goldman. This was Steve's big chance to do a deal on his own. Here's how he described it years later on CNBC.
One of the most proud aspects of my career was buying IndyMac during the financial crisis. We bought it from the government in a highly competitive six-month auction. And we saved a lot of jobs.
This was a great deal for Mnuchin. His group paid the government nothing. In exchange, they got the bank headquarters in Pasadena, 33 bank branches across Southern California, and $6 billion worth of deposits. And they got all of IndyMac's loans, including billions of dollars worth of reverse mortgages, among them the one Sandy's parents took out. Even all these years later, Sheila Bair tells me that was the best deal the government could get.
But you basically sold it for $0, right?
People like to, it's, you know, oh, well, you sold it for nothing. We sold it in return for, it wasn't a check they wrote us, but they were standing behind, they were assuming all of those liabilities that otherwise we were going to have to guarantee ourselves.
She says IndyMac's loans were so bad that the government would have lost a fortune if it had to pay off all that bad debt itself. So even for $0, she says, Steve Mnuchin was doing us all a big favor. And she notes that while Mnuchin and his group didn't pay the government anything, they did agree to invest more than $1 billion in the bank. But here's the thing. When Steve Mnuchin foreclosed on a family like Sandy's and lost money, the government promised to pay almost all the difference.
But actually what their agreement says is that if they lose money, then you'll subsidize that too.
Right. And our losses would have been even higher if we had not offered the loss share, because they probably wouldn't even have taken them.
I showed her a copy of the deal. It's 38 pages long.
But in this case, the government is going to pick up the loss, and not only the loss of the loan, but also, you know, it says here the accrued interest, attorney's fees, foreclosure costs, property protection, tax and insurance, appraisal costs, inspection costs. We're subsidizing all of this.
So I think it's easy 10 years after to say, oh, well, you could have done this and this and this differently.
She says the government had been handling bank takeovers this way as far back as the 1980s. And Sheila Bair notes she did get Steve Mnuchin to agree to one thing, to help the people on the other end of all those bad loans. She paints this as a major victory for homeowners. The deal basically invented mortgage modification programs, which were supposed to help regular people like Sandy Jolly, who were caught in the middle of a national economic catastrophe. By this point, it had been nearly 4 years since Sandy's father died, and she'd taken the bank to court. But now she hoped that with new ownership and a mortgage modification deal in place, the bank might work with her. I stood outside the courthouse as she described the case.
All those years, I kept holding out the hope that justice could be served.
Sandy didn't get a mortgage modification. Instead, she got a years-long court battle. Under Mnuchin's leadership, the bank fought back hard. The central issue? Whether Sandy's parents had the mental capacity to sign the loan. The bank hired an expert witness who examined Sandy's mother. When he interviewed her, Patricia couldn't remember what day of the week it was, the name of her dog, or even how many legs a cow has.
The way I saw this case, maybe in my naive way, was that it was a slam dunk.
But on the stand, the bank's medical expert testified that Sandy's mother did have the mental capacity to sign a reverse mortgage. The case didn't go to trial until 2011. By that point, Sandy's mother had died. And the bank's attorneys, they painted a sinister picture of Sandy's relationship with her parents.
They called me a freeloader living off my parents, that I moved in with my parents because I lost my job, and that I was a greedy, evil child who wanted the property, and I didn't care one whit about my parents, that I didn't love them at all.
The jury sided with the bank. After the trial, the foreman signed a sworn affidavit, saying that although a majority of the jury members thought the bank committed fraud, it didn't matter, because Sandy's father wanted the reverse mortgage. According to the bank's lawyer, her dad even hugged the salesman. The bank's attorneys had done a good job. The foreman said that by the end of the trial, most of the jury didn't like Sandy Jolly. Several said they just didn't want her to get her parents' house.
The bank had successfully put Sandy on trial. She lost in court, but her fight was just beginning.
He who can sustain the most pain wins. This is my investment philosophy.
When we come back, we meet another homewrecker who also found a way to profit off the house on Benson Way. That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.